All right. Are we going?
Beasts of No Nation.
Do you want to do it all in African accents?
I will be saying
I can't even. That was not.
The African. Tense. To me, it wasn't the accent. It was just the tense, how everything seemed like it was in the future. You know, when they would speak, I want to be seeing, we will be podcasting. Not like I am podcasting. And maybe they're fucking right. I don't know, man.
See, it's optimistic. I like that future tense of everything. What's up? This is Movies On Up. Beyond the darkness lies greatness. Next to me is my...
Darkness?
Greatness.
I'm the darkness
to your greatness.
The greatness
to my darkness. The co-host to my other co-host, Mr. Ryan E.B.
Hey, that's me.
Tagline for this week, Beyond the darkness lies greatness. If you know what... Oh, we are Movies On Up.
Ryan. We are. Yeah, that's Dave. I'm Ryan. We're
Movies On Up. If you know what tagline, I'm not saying it for the third time. If you know what that's from, hit us up, moviesonup@gmail.com, facebook.com/moviesonup, or the Twitter, @moviesonup. If you are right and we select you, you will win the glorious Out of This World Movies On Up prize package.
Full of greatness.
This week, Star Trek Beyond's into theater. The Beyond's not really a verb.
Beyond something. I don't know. That might be an adverb. I don't really know.
Star Trek Beyond flies into theaters. It continues the trend of awesome actors being the villains in that movie. As Benedict Cumberbatch was the villain in
one of the greatest movie villains of all time.
Yeah. Idris Elba looks to top that. Originally, we were going to do favorite Idris Elba movies, but we kind of changed that, and we're going to do a different...
We canceled that apocalypse.
We did cancel that apocalypse. God, I wish we'd have done a Pacific Rim episode. We're doing a different Idris Elba movie, and it's more to talk... Idris Elba's a big key part in it. It's Beast of No Nation.
In fairness, Idris Elba's had a really good year.
Awesome.
To this.
Three of my favorite movies. I mean, his voice is in
right.
Three of my favorite
you
movies.
You talked about
this year.
In the halftime report, you throw Star Trek in there. Like, the guy at the box office is going to do very, very well this year. Maybe even better
Zootopia,
than
Dory.
That year Hugo Weaving had, where he was in like The Matrix, Lord of the Rings, and Transformers, I think.
Or when Christopher Lee doing Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. He was a voice in Zootopia, a voice in Finding Dory, although a bit part.
Jungle Book.
Very, very good in Jungle Book. He's got Star Trek Beyond. But near the end of last year, Beasts of No Nation, directed by Cary Fukunaga. Cary Joji Fukunaga. Kind of broke out with season one.
We're just going to call him Cary from here on out.
Yeah, yeah. He kind of broke out with that first season of True Detective. This kind of his movie. Like, it was the first thing he did since that. And he was riding high off of True Detective. Could have taken probably any project he wanted, and yet he took this. And what's interesting is this is a Netflix movie. I mean, that's the simplest way to put it. It had a limited run just to get it eligible for awards, but this is, as plain as could be, a Netflix movie. This was directed, produced, marketed, made to go straight to Netflix. Mm-hmm. So we'll talk a little bit about that. I think we're going to see a lot more as Netflix transitions from just doing shows and really starts becoming a heavy player in movies. But before we get to that, let's talk about Beasts of No Nation, which I feel like Idris Elba could have gotten some award talk for it, but I think what the biggest crime is that Abraham Ata did not
Agu.
Get... Yeah. This kid carried this movie.
And watching it, it's very apparent. It is his movie. We go probably 35, 40 minutes before you meet...
Oh, you don't see Idris Elba.
Right. And really, it is the kid, along with his family, that's carrying the movie at that point. And I did think to myself, did Elba not at least get nominated for this, or it was just maybe talk of that?
There was a push for it.
Yeah, okay.
Because it
didn't actually
happen. It didn't happen because it would have been like a big deal this was like basically the first major film that Netflix did, and to have an Oscar nomination come out of it would have been a big deal.
Would have been huge, and certainly, I guess, if Elba was the guy, I wouldn't argue because his performance was great, but the kid, knowing... It would have made me more upset had Jacob Tremblay not been shafted for Room, but this kid's performance I thought was very much like Tremblay's, and neither of them got nominated, and it was just that kind of year where for whatever reason, we decided, and I don't want to harp on the Oscars again because I made a big stink about giving it to Leo for his career achievement.
In a year where Mark Rylance won for Best Supporting, and does anybody even remember Bridge of Spies, let alone him, where he won for Best Supporting, and you look at something like Elba's performance in here, to not even get nominated.
I would have been upset at this not being nominated, maybe had I seen it beforehand and known. I didn't watch it until, you know, we had to watch it for this episode. But knowing that Tremblay was amazing and wasn't nominated, it kind of made this easier to swallow. I think they're both wrong. I think they both should have been nominated because I think both performances were worthy of not only a nomination, but were better performances than Leo.
Than Leo, yeah.
And that's not to pick on him.
And it's disappointing because it's just last year you could have had two really young Oscar nominations with Atta and Tremblay. This year, I think the kid from Jungle Book should be in the discussion. He won't be.
Right. So if these kids don't.
So that's why we need to take when Kwanzaa Vanna Wallace was nominated. Like, that's a big deal because generally they ignore them.
Well, you're right. Her was nominated, didn't win. Keisha Castle Hughes was nominated years before. Or even like Jodie Foster, who did win. But you look at these kids and you think, well, we're not going to nominate them now because they're nine. They've got the rest of their careers. But in a lot of cases,
it's not the
case. Right, they don't. So
look at Dakota Fanning when she was younger. Like, watching her in her like preteen years, it's like, oh, she's going to win. I'll be shocked if she wins one Oscar her whole life. She'll be around, but look at where she is now. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Elle's outdoing her.
You can't take that for granted. So when these kids do turn in a performance like this, in a movie like this, you have to...
This is a tough movie, and I'm glad you brought up Room, because we can kind of compare those two performances as being completely different. Whereas Tremblay was a child. He played a child that was brought up in a different world, but he still was a child. Abraham Atta, I mean, you can argue that he wasn't a child in this
movie. He was brought
up
in a different world,
yes,
but he was an adult.
Tremblay got to do a lot of the stuff that you would expect from a 5 or 6 year old kid. It was probably easier for him to fight. I'm not trying to discredit
that. He was acting his age.
Yes.
Whereas Atta was acting a completely different character that, I mean, I don't know where the kid's from. Maybe he knows people that were in that position so that he was able to draw on that. But you'd think that would certainly be much more of a stretch than it was for Tremblay to act like a kid that loves his mom, which he did wonderfully.
And that's what, with Tremblay, it's one thing the whole way. Like, he loves his mom at the beginning of the movie. He loves his mom at the end of the movie. Yes, his world changes, but his core is the same. Whereas Atta, from the beginning of the movie to the middle of the movie to the end of the movie, he's essentially three different characters.
Right.
And it was impressive to watch. It really was, because I thought Elba brought it. I didn't think it was just Idris Elba showing up in a supporting role and just showing up being Idris Elba, being really good. No, he brought it. He was intense in this role. He was good. He was, I don't want to say relatable, because it's not, like, it's, he's really not, but yet you felt for him in a way. Like, he was so dedicated and so passionate about what he thought the mission was.
It seems like there was a lot of layers to his character, and he was able to show all those layers.
Without the character showing him, really. Like, the character's this commander, this general, leader of men, and he tries to be that the whole time, and for Elba to show those layers while still being that to his men, I thought was really impressive.
I thought the writing was very good. So if you write a good character, it's easier for a good actor to portray a great character. And there was a lot of facets to the Commandant's character, where on the one hand, yes, he is a rebel and is a freedom fighter. On the other hand, he's basically a soldier of fortune. And on the third hand, he's a child rapist. All of these things, when you first meet him, you don't know if he's going to be a villainous character or if he's going to be some kind of a father figure, which he envisioned him in himself for Stryker and for Aku.
That's what he thought he was, yeah.
Oh, yeah, and he mentions it several times all the way up to the end of the movie that he says he's his father. But it's a very complex character. Once the rebels show up and, spoiler alert, kill Aku's family, from that point on, every character is multifaceted. You said that the kid has to portray three characters, which he does. You know, he's got his innocence. even when he first becomes a soldier, he's much different than when we see him when they get to the Capitol and mm-hmm. he's indiscriminately shooting people in the head,
yeah.
or maybe very discriminately.
I guess four phases, pretty much. Like,
yeah, there's a lot of variance in these characters. They're not good.
It's a journey.
They're like, not bad. Yeah. Yeah, it's all part of the journey. At this particular slice of time, the kid's good. And then he becomes...
And it's a surroundings thing. Like, it's not...
Right.
It's for survival. It's about... Yes. I do want to touch on the direction, because I think Fukunaga's fantastic. I thought the first season of A True Detective, I thought was terribly written. Not, and so was the second. I mean, I just... That dude I don't respect as a writer. I think he's a terrible writer. But I think Fukunaga took that first season and kind of did some really special stuff with it. The tracking shot comes to mind, episode 3 or 4, where it's like a 5-minute shot. And you see some of that there is the war stuff coming into villages and stuff. I think it's some of the best war stuff
I think
I've
was
seen.
A great war movie.
That's exactly what while I'm watching it, I'm just thinking, like, people praise, like, Saving Private Ryan and stuff and Platoon, and it's like, I think this is right there with them. Not hyperbole.
It's not
like,
to me, it wasn't as visceral in that you don't see the blood and guts, but that's not what it's about.
You see the brutality where it's just, I have a gun, there's a person, I'm shooting them. Mm-hmm. That's it. Like, you're walking into this village, you're shooting everybody.
And certainly when it's, you know, a kid that's 8, however old Aku was at the time, it's more, I guess it affects you more when you see that from a child. And Saving Private Ryan, these guys are 18 into their probably 30s, whatever Tom Hanks was supposed to have been at that time. And for whatever reason, I guess that's not as, it's supposed to not be as big of a deal. We expect that from men in a time of war. We don't expect it from kids. But I think Carrey is a fantastic writer. I love Sin Hombre. It's a movie that we had on a list not too long ago. And I don't remember what it was, but I do remember Sin Hombre and City of God were both on the list. I love those movies, and that was really the first time I had come across him, was from that movie. And that should have made me really want to run out and see this. Everything I love about Sin Hombre is in Beasts of No Nation. I think the characters are written very well. The protagonists are, even if they do bad things, they're still very, very relatable. And the cinematography, I think, is wonderful.
Oh, God. It's a beautiful movie. Like,
yeah,
really,
if a war movie can be beautiful, I mean, this one, and there are a couple shots that are really outstanding, and the one of them, I think Aku takes some kind of drug. I don't know if he's, at that point, if he's snorting the gunpowder, or if, I think they smeared something on his head that may have been an opiate of some kind, but they attack a city at that point, and, like, everything's, it's got this red hue, and it's just all violence and brutality, and they're killing everything, and
he does subtle stuff with colors. There's a scene with Elba where it's daylight and it just changes to blue, like, out of nowhere. And it feels so natural. Like, it's done so, not really subtly, because the whole color changes and you notice it, but it feels right.
But it happens organically and not...
It doesn't come off like a trick. It doesn't come off like a gimmick.
Like a George Lucas scene transition where it's a wipe.
Yeah. The direction, I think, was fantastic. And along with that, I always talk about moments in movies and how you have to get moments right. And this movie has quite a few of them that I think they just nailed. The first 5-10 minutes of this movie where Agu is playing with his friends and it's, you know, he's
the imagination TV.
Yeah, and he's living with his family. It's like, it feels like I'm going to watch Son of Rambo. It's a happy, joyous experience, like, just watching these kids, the, you know, their interaction with people trying to sell them the TV and the change in the channels, his interaction with the TV, his brother, mm-hmm. when he wraps him up and he starts dancing, he's like, I can't take this dancing, I didn't sign up for this. And it's really joyous. It's really, really, you're sucked in to where, like,
they build that dynamic.
He's
so,
a kid.
Yeah.
He's a kid. Like, it's not just, oh, here's an 8-year-old kid. You know what an 8-year-old kid looks like. Here's one.
Here's
no,
his family, so
this
that they
is
all
him
matter
being
to
a
you.
Kid. There was that childlike wonder, that joy. And then when the mom and the baby go away, that's when it starts to change. That's a moment. The dad is doing everything he can to keep his family safe, and he's trying to hold Agu back, and like, you're around men now, like, you can't show weakness. And that scene is so hard to watch, where it's just this family that he loves is going away, and who knows when he'll ever see him again. And then when it all just starts going down, I mean, just that whole sequence to where eventually the dad and the brother and him are there. The dad sacrifices himself, essentially. You know, the brother doesn't make it. And then you lead up to Idris Elba. Like, all of that, that's such a roller coaster. And there's so many moments and so many feels and different types of feelings in that first 45 minutes than a lot of movies are able to do in a full length. So, I mean, by the time the story even gets going, it's a journey already. Like, you're already on the ride. I mean, the movie is long. From that point, there's still like another hour and a half. What he needed to hit was nailed, I thought. Once the war stuff starts happening, I feel like you lose more moments, because I think you're, at that point, I don't think you're supposed to feel anything, because you're just watching this brutality, and this feelings are out the window at this point, because this is just the brutal reality of what's going on. Because Agu loses all emotion along the way. Like, he loses track of everything.
Until that scene at the Capitol where he thinks he's found his mom again. And that, I guess, does kind of wake him out of that sort of day-to-day, I'm sort of checking out, just doing what I need to do to make sure that I don't get killed. And it's that potential reunion with his mom that kind of snaps him out of it. He does become sort of a human being again. And I think that's when he kind of reevaluates his situation, and it's not long from there that he decides, screw you guys, I'm going home.
Yeah, it's a hard one to rewatch, I think. Like, it's not one I'm gonna just like, oh, I'm in the mood to watch Beasts of No Nation.
Right, I'm free on a Saturday afternoon.
It's a movie that's definitely worth watching, though, because I think it's great. Visually, it's beautiful. But I guess we'll transition that into where I want to go with this is, like, it's a beautiful movie.
Mm-hmm.
Sound mixing was great. Like, the war stuff sounded very real and engaging. They knew making it, it was going to be essentially viewed in your living room. But it wasn't made. It wasn't made like that. It was made. You watch this and it's like, oh, I could see this on a big screen.
Right.
This would be a big screen, would enhance this experience. The whole Netflix movie thing is very interesting to me.
They've got, I read, 600 hours of original programming that's going to come out this year between TV shows and movies. They have a budget of $5 billion for TV and movie projects. And a lot of the movie stuff they're getting into now, it's not necessarily Netflix, the content producer, as they are on some of these television shows, where if it's like an Arrested Development that they bring back, or Voltron that they bring back, or like one of their newer properties, like Orange is the New Black, or that Sense8, or House of Cards, any of those. The movies, it seems like they kind of want to go into the distributor route. And I think it was that Tallulah that they bought, the Ellen Page movie, Allison Janney. They bought that at Sundance, well, really a week before Sundance even started. So that will be a Netflix movie. But it's really just Netflix as a distributor, rather than it being purchased by Fox Searchlight.
Whereas this was made and funded by Netflix.
Right, it was. But it's sort of my hope that, and this was great, I'm glad they did this, because this was a tremendous movie. There's a lot of times where, and it's a function of where, you know, Dave and I live, it's hard to see Room. It would be hard to see Tallulah, which I want to see.
Yeah.
But if it becomes a Netflix movie, I'm going to be able to see it from my living room, and that's tremendous.
They're in a great position because they can have the best of both worlds. They can put up the money to make this movie, and this is from the ground up. This
right.
is a Netflix movie.
Yes.
They have that Brad Pitt one coming out. They have the Sandler deal, which was, I think, a six-picture deal that they're...
They paid $90 million for the rights to Bright, that Will Smith cop movie.
Yeah.
I mean, they're going to be producing that, I assume.
Yeah.
It's $90 million just to be able to do it.
So, I mean, you have these to where they're involved from the way up. Like, mm-hmm. they're producing it. It's all done through them. But then you also have them doing the Sundance circuit, the festival circuit, to where they're buying as distribution. And it's to a point now where a few years ago it became a thing to where, oh, we'll do VOD and theatrical release on the same day just to try to expand our audience. I think this is a better avenue than that.
Certainly. And I think that in some instances, wasn't it Tower Heist that was trying to do that?
They tried to do like, but it was like $60.
Yeah. Super expensive to see it day of release. Something like Tallulah, for example, like, it's not a VOD. It's part of your regular subscription. So I'm not going to have to pay any more to see it. As a matter of fact, it leaves money in my pocket because I don't have to go see it at a theater.
And in our area, you don't have to drive an hour to see it.
Exactly. I mean, we'd have to drive to Cleveland to see something like that or hope that the big multiplex brings something in on a couple weekends around award season to see. But I mean, there was a movie that I had talked about a couple weeks ago. We did our magic list, and the one I love was one of my movies. And I talked about that director has a new movie called The Discovery with Jason Segel and Rooney Mara. That's purchased by Netflix. That's going to be a Netflix movie, which is phenomenal because that movie interests the hell out of me. And I'm going to be able to see it without having to travel what I feel like is maybe a little further than I should have to see a movie. So keep bringing me the content that I like. Keep bringing me another season of Daredevil. I love to see House of Cards. For whatever, I'm the guy that watches Marco Polo. But give me all of that, and then
Stranger Things comes out in like a week.
Yeah,
that looks
yeah.
like Stephen King and Steven Spielberg got high and made a series and got Winona Ryder in there. Like,
who do you think brought the weed?
And I think of movies like in the past, something like Mystery Team. It may be an odd example, but like Derek Comedy, where these YouTube stars, they just put up sketches on YouTube. They saved all the money they made from YouTube and funded a movie and took it to Sundance. If that's the kind of thing Netflix gets into, I feel like that movie becomes even bigger. I mean, not even bigger. Not that it was huge, but like that, you're going right to its audience. And you have more and more YouTube stars and people coming from YouTube making movies and stuff. And legit movies, not just movie versions of their YouTube channel. I feel like Netflix is the perfect step from there because you have your fan base that's used to watching you on the computer.
And they're still watching you on maybe your computer.
You're not asking them to get up and leave the house.
Tablet.
So, like, in the case of something like Derek Comedy, like, that's when Sundance comes in, that's the kind of stuff that I want to see them do, is get those movies that, yeah, the audience is going to be a niche audience, but what's the easiest way to deliver, get a niche audience out? Go to them.
And that's
and
it.
And Netflix is really the only distributor that can guarantee I'm putting you in front of your audience.
Outside of maybe Amazon, I mean, to me, that's it. It's about distribution. That's what sets Netflix apart from like a Fox Searchlight. Fox Searchlight can put you on 3,000 screens. Netflix has 81 million subscribers. They can put you on 81 million screens. They can put you on 58 million just in the U.S. alone. So do I need a Netflix Adam Sandler movie? No. I can go to the multiplex and see Grown Ups 2 if I want to. Do I need Netflix to write a check for $90 million to get a Will Smith movie? No, I can see that too. I'd rather they took that $90 million, bought four movies at Sundance that would be a pain in my ass to see and deliver them to my ass. That's where I think Netflix and Amazon could really be gangbusters, is getting some of these independent movies and bringing them to us, and that being the only way that you can see them. I can see a Will Smith cop movie at the theater.
That's not dope, though. I can't wait for that.
No,
movie.
It does. And I don't mean to like kind of knock it down, but that's the kind of stuff that I can get somewhere else. If you wanted to see Beast of No Nation, if you were super curious about it, you have to watch it through Netflix. And they make it easy. It's $8 a month.
Your first 30 days are free.
$10 a month, whatever it is now. Yeah. To me, that's what Netflix brings to the table. Do they have the facilities and the capabilities to make movies and TV shows? Obviously, they do. But lots of people do. What they have that is unique is that 58 million subscribers in the United States, 81 million across the globe, that you instantly can put a movie in front of. And I think that's the most valuable thing.
And I mean, they're set up to succeed with TV shows. House of Cards was their first big get. They were battling with HBO for it, but Netflix can say, hey, we'll give you two seasons. Guarantee you two seasons. They don't have to worry about ratings or anything.
No, because they don't release them.
That's why House of Cards went. They've even said, like, oh, we went to Netflix because they guaranteed us more. HBO would have done one season, and then we'd have had to wait to get renewed. Done a second season, had to wait to get renewed. Like, Netflix can just throw out, here, a couple seasons for you. This is something that's interesting in my head that I don't know if it's just me or if it's a widespread thing. Idris Elba was Oscar-worthy. I feel like he should have been nominated. Abraham Atta should have been nominated. If this is an HBO movie that does the same thing, does the theatrical runs, follows the same rules, do you feel the same way? I feel like there's a stigma with, like, HBO movies that it's, oh, it's still a made-for-TV movie.
Yeah, I think you're right. There can be a little of a stigma there.
But I feel like Netflix has just bypassed that completely.
It has bypassed it, but I do think that studios are going to start to get pissed at Netflix.
Oh, absolutely. Theaters are.
Yes.
For sure.
Right.
Because you look at The Do-Over or mm-hmm. The Ridiculous Six. Yeah. Like, what separates those from any of the garbage Adam Sandler's done?
Nothing.
Nothing. You put those in theaters, they're not going to be $100 million movies because he hasn't really had those recently except for The Grown-Ups. But you're still losing the theaters
out. You're taking butts out of seats.
You're taking butts out of seats. And theaters hated the VOD thing, mm-hmm. whereas some theaters will refuse to show the VOD theater same-day movies just because
butts out of seats.
Butts out of seats. And I know that Netflix had issues with the Crouching Tiger sequel.
Yeah.
They wanted to show it in IMAX. IMAX is like, no, absolutely not. So theaters aren't happy. Mm-hmm. Studios aren't going to be happy because they're changing the game. Now you have to compete with them.
You got to compete with all your other. It's another giant studio that just kind of came. A studio with a budget of $5 billion.
A studio that just got into movies.
Yeah.
And is now a major player. Like, they worked their way up a completely different way. So, I mean, are Netflix movies legit? Is this something that's just going to get bigger and bigger? I mean, you have a Brad Pitt, you have a Will Smith movie coming.
Certainly, I think if you just look at the shows, Kevin Spacey, they've got guys that are legit doing their TV shows, and their TV shows are wonderful. There's no reason to believe that the movies Netflix produces wouldn't be just as good. And the ones they're buying, if they're not bought by Netflix, they'd be bought by some other independent distributor. They'd be released. They'd get Oscar love. That's who I'm going to feel bad for, is like an Ellen Page, if she turns in a hell of a performance in Tallulah, isn't going to be nominated because it's a Netflix movie and you're just going to have to eat it.
And that's where I wonder is, like, they are trying to get young blood into the Academy. And I think it just takes that one. And maybe we were eager that Idris or Aha Atta would be the first ones in, like, their big debut. But I think it just takes that one nominee from a Netflix movie before it's like, oh, yeah, these are legit movies. Like, these are real movies. They're not made for TV movies. I mean, there's some HBO movies that are great, but I just feel like there's a different stigma there.
And maybe
the guy that directed Dope just did that Confirmation movie that was phenomenal.
And maybe it's just a difference between TV and film, but I mean, Netflix stuff gets nominated for Emmys.
Exactly.
And nobody bats an eye at that.
Yeah, and I guess you can kind of understand the correlation between TV and computer are not as far as computer and movie theater.
And the further along we go, you know, that it's all going to be the same anyway. You know what I mean? The screens become screens. There's
exactly
a little difference between your tablet and then your laptop and your TV.
If anything, I hope it changes the VOD game, the video on demand game. Like, I liked the idea.
Tower Heist
tried. I like the thought of a major movie coming out, and say when Zootopia comes out, I can go to the movies and spend that money on tickets with my kids and then concessions, or I can drop $40 or $50 to watch it from home. Like, to me, that's reasonable. If it's around the same price I would be to take it out, like when I have multiple children, absolutely. That's something that I would be way into. Something like Star Trek. I'm not a Trekkie. I love the first two movies. I have friends that really like those movies. Like, if it's, hey, come over, we'll order pizza, we'll split. If it takes a pay-per-view approach where it's like, hey, it's $50-$60, but if you split it three ways or two ways, like, I mean, I think 40 to 50 is probably my max. Like, I can't see going more than that. But I would like to see Netflix kind of change the VOD game just to hang with it and compete. And when you're getting Brad Pitt and Will Smith movies, and I mean, this is a David Ayer movie. Like, yeah. I really like what Netflix is doing. They changed the TV game. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to see what they do from here on out with movies. And I think Beasts was, I don't think it was technically the first movie they made, but I think it was the first, like, the first one to say, like, hey, we're legit movies now. Because you look at their TV shows, House of Cards.
Yeah.
They've established a brand. Marco Polo doesn't look interesting to me, but I'm sure it's a quality show just because their brand, Bloodline, House of Cards, you know, Stranger Things coming out, yeah. The Marvel shows, they have a brand to where the stuff is very, very quality. And if they establish that as movies, like, I'll watch a movie that probably I wouldn't see otherwise.
And to be honest with you, if you didn't know Beasts of No Nation really didn't have much of a theatrical release, you wouldn't be able to tell. It looks like any other movie, and the shows look like any other shows. They don't cut corners on production values, and that's why, to me, their stuff stands up next to what I would see on a network or what I'd see on a premium cable or what I'd see in the theater. And I do think that it's certainly on the television side or show side. It's hard to even say television when we're talking about streaming services. But, you know, Amazon's kind of stepping their game up, too. They've got that Mozart in the Jungle, which is pretty cool. They've got a couple shows, not quite as many as Netflix. But I think it's really only a matter of time before you see Amazon get into.
They're still waiting for that House of Cards.
Yeah.
Like, from the comedy standpoint, they've had some good comedies. But, like, Bosch and Hand of God are these really good, gritty dramas that they don't have the magic that House of Cards or Bloodline or something do. Like, they're good quality shows, but they're not, oh my God, I have to tell everybody I know that you need
to
watch this.
They're not water cooler the next day.
Yes.
And
that, yeah, they need one of those to, right, legit. They're doing a lot better with the comedy scene than the actual movies, but, or shows. But I mean, they might get there.
I'm backed by Amazon. I'm sure they'll get there. It's, yeah, just a matter of, it's when, not if. And then I do think, you know, studios are going to have to adjust what they do. Either they're going to have to bid more money for these indie movies that they want. You know, something like, hell, like Whiplash a couple of years ago. Like, I could totally see that being an Amazon or a Netflix movie and seeing it on Netflix. If a studio really wants that because they know J.K. Simmons is going to get an Oscar for it, yeah, and they want to put their money behind it, they're going to have to put more money behind it. I look at it because I'm not a producer, I'm not in the movie business, so I don't care about them and how they make money. For me, I think it's a good thing. Maybe I'm being short-sighted, but I think it gives us as a consumer another viable way to consume great content, and I don't see a problem with that.
And what's great is that Netflix, they can bid more for these movies because from a studio standpoint, you're looking at it like, okay, we could pay this much for this movie because we'll have to spend this much on marketing, this, yeah, much on the promotional tour to get it out in theaters and on distribution altogether, whereas, right, Netflix could just be like, we could just pay this.
And we're going to put it.
Our marketing's built in. The, yeah, preview will be when you first sign into Netflix.
Uh-huh.
You know, we'll do some print ads, but
it'll,
whatever,
be on that first slide, so,
yeah,
it's always,
yeah,
right,
so,
up,
I,
there.
So, I mean, Netflix, all of, yeah, it's built in, whereas a movie studio wants to set aside $1.5 million for the rights and then two or three for everything else. Netflix could spend three on just that part that the other studio wants to spend $1.5 on because everything else is built into that.
And really, I mean, if you think about it, Netflix, what would be the reason for them to buy a movie? For that exclusivity, their subscribers have essentially plateaued. So at this point, they're making all the money that they can make out of America. They either have to raise the rates, which they've done, or they have to try and expand in different markets, which they are doing. They're putting a much heavier focus on China, which I believe is the second largest market in the world behind only the U.S. But by adding exclusives that, you know, if I weren't a Netflix subscriber now and I loved Will Smith and I wanted to see his new movie, guess what? I have to. Yeah.
It's not the days of, oh, I'll wait till it comes on VOD. I'll wait till it comes out on DVD. I'll,
right,
wait till it comes on HBO. Gone.
Yep.
Doesn't exist with these movies.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, I'll wait till it comes on Netflix, which is how it's released.
And they'll take their chances that, yeah, maybe people are only going to use the first 30 days, watch that one Will Smith movie
take
and bounce,
it.
But
that chance.
Probably not.
Yeah, because you know what? Another movie will come out that they want, that 30 days is gone.
Or,
so.
Oh, you know what? I've heard so much about this House of Cards show. Let me get into that. And then you're down that rabbit hole.
So I'm excited to see what Netflix does to the movie landscape, just like I'm excited to see Idris Elba in Star Trek Beyond, written by Simon Pegg. So I'm excited for that movie. It seems to be late in the summer for that, though. It seems like there's not as much, like, buzz about.
Yeah, I thought they were, like, generally April, May.
No, they've been summer, but
really?
It feels like they were earlier summer. This just seems late summer. It's been a heavy summer, though, so I guess I get it. Maybe lack of buzz because of lack of JJ. I don't know. But it just doesn't seem like this has the hoopla around it that the previous two have had.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, going back to the first one, can this franchise be successfully relaunched? And then they answered that question. And then the second one, oh gosh, are they doing the whole Khan storyline? And that was good buzz leading up to it. This one, most of what you hear
Sulu's
is like,
gay.
Yeah, exactly. And Takei's pissed off about that. So like, that's the buzz going into this one.
People hated the first trailer because it looked too actiony. Because it was a 90-second teaser that was played the Beastie Boys and just showed. Now you have a Rihanna song over it that. Over the new one, which
do you like that any better?
I mean, I like the first one. I really like the first trailer.
It was fine.
I don't like Star Trek.
I don't really give a shit.
I don't care about Star Trek. I don't care anything about Star Trek.
No, if they want to make Star Trek more like Star Wars, I might like it.
But
more,
I love
so
this franchise.
Up, win.
I love the two JJ ones, and I'm excited for this Fast and the Furious Star Trek. So. That's our Idris Elba Visa No Nation episode. We'll be back next week. I'm sure we have an awesome episode planned for that, probably. So we'll see you next week when we talk about...
Cast of Bad Moms.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that movie comes out in theaters next week, and we don't really want to talk about that. So there are a lot of bad moms in that cast, so we'll give you our
favorite movies featuring the cast of Bad Moms.
Yeah,
I think it's Mila Kunis,
Kristen
Bell,
Applegate,
Christina Applegate, and Jada Pinkett Smith.
Yeah, I had a fifth one in there just because she's in the movies.
Was it Catherine Hahn?
Yep.
I love Catherine Hahn, but
me
she
too.
Hasn't like starred in anything.
No, she hasn't.
She's been in a lot of great bit parts, but
yep.
I left her off
intentionally. But I put one of her bit parts in there because I like the movie.
That's why I specifically on the list when I suggested the episode listed those four. Mm. But whatever, we'll argue about it next week. But until next week,
keep it up.